Hello, it's lovely to be back, and my thanks to the wonderful Sarah Konofsky for filling in for me. Christopher Bintz is a notorious criminal, and he currently resides in a high-security unit at Barwon Prison in Victoria. Christopher Bintz has spent nearly all his life in prison. On his brief forays in the outside world, he would often use a pump-action shotgun to hold up a bank or an armoured car. Christopher Bintz hasn't really shot or physically assaulted any police or members of the public in these armed robberies. But, of course, people at the scene have had to live with the terror and trauma that he's inflicted on them. One of the reasons why Christopher Bintz is held in a supermax unit is that he is a brilliant escape artist. Bintz has broken out from imprisonment and police custody several times, showing enormous daring, intelligence and cunning. On the outside, he would taunt police with postcards, and once by placing a three-word ad in the paper announcing simply that Badness is back. The name Badness, with the last two S's turned into dollar signs, was a nickname that he relished. But now he spends 23 hours a day in solitary confinement, which is deranging him, like it would anyone. My guest today is Dr. Matthew Thompson, who's an author and journalist, and Matthew's also a fellow at the Centre for the History of Violence at the University of Newcastle, which sounds like a seriously interesting course of study. Matthew has gained access to Christopher Badness Bintz and to members of his family so he could tell his story. And just a brief heads up for you, this is a man who spent nearly all his adult life in jail, and so we'll be talking about all kinds of dark and messy stuff. Matthew Thompson's book is called Mayhem, The Strange and Savage Saga of Christopher Badness Bintz. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, Richard.
How solitary is this confinement that Christopher Bintz is living in?
Well, he's, for the last 4 years since he got arrested last time, he's never in the company of another prisoner. So he spends about, 22, 23 sometimes, it varies a bit, hours in his cell. And his cell is like, I don't know, living in a little caravan. And he's just there on his own. And then for the other hour or two, that's when he's taken out to use the telephone to ring his mother, or taken to an exercise yard sometimes. But those areas are cleared first of other prisoners. So he's just completely on his own as a prisoner the whole time. And then he's entering his fifth straight year of this, and then brought back, taken back to his cell and put back in there. So that's it. There's no other prisoners in his company ever.
What's in the cell? Does he have a TV or books in the cell?
He has TV, radio, some books, but not Mayhem, not the book about him. I tried to take it to him in prison last week, and it was blocked, and apparently on orders of the governor, he's not allowed to read it. So he can't read his own life story. He's allowed to watch, you know, any number of Ivan Milat specials on TV or something, but not a book about himself.
Why won't they let him read the book you've written about him?
Well, I asked him that, and they told me, they said, look, I'm not entering into a theological debate with you, mate. And that was it. The answer's no.
Oh, so, just no.
Just no.
Just no, like that.
Yeah.
Who are his neighbours in this unit?
Well, he's just shifted, but until recently, he was neighbours with Matthew Johnson, who's the fellow who beat Carl Williams to death, who's killed apparently a couple of people and is the boss of a big prison gang. There's a fellow called Sean Price, who stabbed a teenage girl to death in Melbourne and then sexually assaulted a woman and then handed himself into police, who apparently has schizophrenia and is in the grip of delusions a lot of the time. And another fellow, Tommy Ivanovich, who's a murderer as well, who shot someone dead after a road rage incident. And then there's Chris. And so although the prisoners can't see, well, they're never in the same room, they can hear each other yell. So on TV, sometimes you get the impression from those current affairs shows that they don't know who is anywhere. It's a totally solitary world in every way, but they can yell at each other. So in the area he was in, Matthew Johnson, who has cheered on slashing attacks on Chris before, because Chris won't join gangs or anything and is always on his own, would yell death threats and taunts and things to Chris. Sean Price would just be ranting and raving in the grip of delusions. He's a schizophrenic fellow just in solitary confinement. And then Chris is trying to work on his appeals, write his life story to get bits of it out to me. Understand himself better and all this, and this is the so-called rehabilitative environment. It's four men with severe problems in adjoining cages, screaming death threats, rage and delusions at each other all day from morning till late at night.
In the past, you've written books about going to Colombia, for example, where you might have ended up in another life, actually, as it turns out, and writing about the drug cartels there and the kind of day-to-day insane life in that kind of world in Colombia. Why have you chosen to write the story of this man, this notorious armed robber?
Well, partly because it's harder to get into anything in Australia. One reason I've gone to Colombia, the southern Philippines, Iran, all sorts of places in extreme circumstances, was because it's easier to meet people in those countries, even if they're in the grip of turmoil. But in Australia, everything's so secretive, locked off, regulated, bureaucratic. You just hit brick wall after brick wall. And when I first contacted Chris, I was blocked, you know, struck off his list of contacts, not allowed to ring me anymore. I couldn't meet him. And I thought, to hell with that, you know, I'm going to do this anyway. So I did. But I guess deeper than that is just the same thing with all my writing is a real desire to see what it's like to be someone else. I feel like any of us could be born. It's just a quirk of fate where we're born and when. Chris grew up in poverty with a deeply broken home, all kinds of trouble. And I could have been, anyone could have been, you know. But we're so easy to judge people, whether they're armed rebels, criminals, police, guards, protesters, anti-protesters, anyone. We're all so quick to judge each other. And I thought, I'm just going to pour myself into this and see what makes such a furious man. You know, the man that Andrew Rule, the Underbelly co-author, is called the Mad Max of Supermax.
The Mad Max of Supermax. How do you approach the Mad Max of Supermax and say, hello, you don't know me, but I want to write your life story?
Well, I wrote to him and said that I wanted to see what his spirit is like, you know. He's pulled off these incredible escapes, and he's never been sort of, until now, been just crushed by you know, a hard-as-hell system. So I wanted to understand that, and this is what I told him. And I said, I'm interested in what makes you you, and, you know, where you find freedom, or if you do or not, just what you are, you know, what kind of species you are. And he rang me up and, yeah, mate, this is Chris. Yeah, oh, I'm happy to talk to you, but my mum will have to tell me you're all right first, so she's going to suss you out a bit. And then a bit
you
later,
had to be checked out by his mum?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, this is the Mad Max of Supermax.
So did she call you or did you call her?
She called me.
Yeah.
Like a few hours later, and we had a long chat. She hates the press, you know. She feels that they turn reporters, crime reporters and things, just routinely turn people like her son into cartoon bad guys, and everything's black and white, and, you know, the worst of the worst, and the jail system has to be the way it is and everything, and sensationalize, make up stuff and all this, and treat them like a fool. And I said, look, you know, what I do, whether it's the head of the, you know, the right-wing death squads in Colombia that I met, or Muslim or communist rebels in the Philippines or others, is just listen to them, understand what makes them tick as best I can, and present that on the page and let the reader make up, you know, her or his own mind. So we talked about this for a while, and she just said, okay, we'll give you a chance. And so I went down. I was going to meet Chris then, and she rang up and said, don't bother coming for that. You've been banned, you know, and then prison banned me then. So after that, I started going down to Melbourne and staying with her. And Chris asked her and the family to open everything up to me, tell me everything, show me all their documents, family history.
Family photos, everything.
Yeah.
Why did the prison ban you? Did they give you a reason? Did they feel the need to oblige to give you a reason?
Well, there's no real reasons.
In the past, we do know he does have a history of having people visiting him in prisons and slipping him hacksaws and all kinds of and a gun on one occasion. So,
yeah.
I mean, maybe it's reasonable to say you can't go and visit him as an outsider. Maybe
most of the time he's got hacksaw blades in. It's not through any visitors. It's, through other means in the jail, which you can read about in there. He's like, for example, once he had them thrown over a fence at Parramatta, and the payment for that was attached to the hacksaw blades were Serapacs and syringes for some of the druggy prisoners to use. But basically, it's always other means, you know. For visitors, they have to go through heavy security. When I went to Barwon Prison last weekend, or the one before now, you go through this machine that blows air all over you and can sense, you know, drugs and things. There's heavy searches, metal detectors, explosive wands, all kinds of things. So, you know, it's pretty hard to smuggle in things. I don't know if he can get the book in. Maybe he can get hacksaw blades, drugs, guns, but I don't know if he's going to get the book.
So you've been speaking to him on the phone, essentially,
yeah,
this whole time. How is he when you talk to him on the phone? What's he like?
He's funny, irreverent, manipulative, very strong-willed, driven, interested, but sometimes very sad, you know. Like when I asked him about his family troubles that he hadn't really thought about, or he had thought about, but he'd suppressed them for years, you know, trouble with his dad and his anger at his mother and all this stuff. He'd bring back later and just be flat, and then it's like, mate, I'm in a dark place now and all this. And it would take him a while to get back into things, you know. But then when he's back into things, he talks a million miles an hour and his mind is scattered. It jumps all over the place, you know, because he gets these like 11 or 12-minute phone calls and a couple of those, and then that's it, you know. So his mind is bracing because he's a smart guy.
Oh, he's figured out what he's going to say to you and give you this kind of big data dump, if you like, on the phone.
Yeah, but on, you know, 800 different things at once.
Right.
And sometimes they're, you know, centered around a couple of interests of his. Other times it's like everything that was wrong with his defenses or how he, you know, he's written all his children's books too, and he wants kids to learn not to be like him. And he's running me through all his theories of child development, you know, and then he jumps from that to how he's angry that his ex-girlfriends, you know, took his suits and Rolexes or something, and thieves kind of cheese him off. And then I remind him that he's an armed robber, and it's like, yeah, man, I guess there's some irony there, you know. And,
The reason why I'm asking is it sounds like a dangerous book to write in some ways, to be a writer, because you've got to enter into this world of a very charismatic and manipulative and clever man who's in a very hellish situation, and you're kind of his one link that might be able to explain him to the outside world. You know, it's that abyss you might fall into.
Well, it's a strange...
The abyss that stares back.
It's deeply weird, you know, like, because at the beginning too, I should say, when I first started talking to him, he said to me, you know, when you've got this together, when it's all kind of working out and all that, when you've got the book in hand, basically, I'm going to give you the tragic ending this book needs in order for the message that solitary confinement is destructive to get out. And he's talking about suicide, you know. And I said to him, well, you've given the book the tragic ending it needs. You're doing 18 years in solitary. And he just said, oh, screw that, you know, I'm not sticking around for that. And so the whole time has been this thing that he's going to die when it gets to completion, the project. And, you know, I said to him, I hope you don't do that. Like, I don't live your life. I'm not in your skin, you know, but, you know, I hope you don't do that. And he goes, yeah, fair enough, but this is intolerable. And so anyway, this year, as it's been wrapped up, there's been multiple suicide attempts, you know, like he's just doesn't want to spend the next 14 years in solitary confinement. And so he's you know, cut veins. He's tried to hang himself. He wants to die.
You mentioned there a badly broken home. In what way is it badly broken? Give me paint a picture of his early life with his mum and his dad.
His dad was a Croatian immigrant whose own father, Chris's grandfather outside, was shot dead by the Ustasha, the fascist forces in Croatia. And then he was a disturbed kid himself, and apparently a bit of a bandit back in his village in Croatia, and caused a hell of a lot of trouble there. And then the family didn't want him around anymore, so they apparently shipped him out to Australia and, you know, start a new life and all that kind of thing. On his mother's side, his mother, you know, is no criminal or bandit or outlaw or
no, she's no Ma Baker, I think. That's how she puts it, isn't she?
Yeah.
She's not part of that at all.
No. Know? But her parents are quite disturbed from World War II. So Annette, the mother, Chris's mother, was born in Germany to an ethnic German woman from the Ukraine who'd been just deeply traumatized. Like, her family were deported to Siberia, but she missed the train out, whatever, so she just never saw her family again as a teenager. All of a sudden, they're just all gone and no contact at all anymore. A neighboring family took her in, and then Soviet troops swept through later and you know, just did over every ethnic German woman en route to Berlin. You know?
So both Christopher's parents then have in some way suffered from the traumas of the Second World War.
Yeah.
And so they met and got married.
Yeah. So they... the mother, like Chris's grandmother on the mother's side, her mind just snapped, you know, after all this. And she developed schizophrenia. Her dad's a Russian, really hard, austere man with mysterious bullet wounds and things from the war. Chris's mother has to look after her own mother because her parents split up. So she's caring for a mother with schizophrenia. She's married to a man who's who's disturbed this Croatian fellow, Steve, who starts beating the absolute hell out of her. Like, even when she's pregnant and stuff, he's beating her up. And she eventually leaves him once his mother also bashes her. Like, Annette's mother-in-law beat her while cousins and others stand on laughing and things. Like, it's a weird, screwed-up, like, community she's found herself amongst, you know.
And what did Christopher think as a boy of the marriage breaking up? Who did he side with one mum or dad on this?
He sided emotionally with the dad, as in because the dad was encouraging him to be as wild and bold a boy as he could. So he would get love and attention and presents and things the more he acted out. And the dad was a petty criminal too, and he would take Chris and Chris's brother out stealing, pilfering from work sites and things. And you know,
so mum's the one who says don't, and dad's the one who says go right ahead, and here's how you do it. So so no wonder he likes dad more under those circumstances.
That's right. Like, dad is the removal of all inhibitions and limits, and mother is the imposition of them, you know.
I've seen all the pictures you've got of him as a boy, of Christopher Bince as a boy in this. They're all the same. He's got this really wired look as a 8-year-old, as a 10-year-old, as a 12-year-old. His eyes are, armchair psychology, you know, from a distance and all that sort of. But he seems to be like a kid who would perhaps be diagnosed as classic ADHD these days. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, other people I've spoken to, like psych people and so on, say, you know, pretty much for sure he would be. He's a rampant, undiagnosed case of ADHD. I mean, he was apparently not sadistic, not malicious.
No torturing animals, nothing like that?
No, but relentlessly naughty pranks, wild physical feats, just causing trouble all the time and having a laugh. And then, you know, things like he'd put a dead mouse in a jar and give it to his mum just to freak her out, you know, carry dead snakes in as if they're alive, just everyone's worst nightmare of a little kid, but not mean-hearted.
You've got a long list of his charge sheet through his childhood and teenage years. It's just like petty theft, again and again, or a bit of mayhem here and there.
Yeah.
Mum finally couldn't deal with it, so she handed him over to the state, put him in state's custody, and he was sent to juvenile detention. What happened to him in juvenile detention in the late 70s, I think, wouldn't it?
Very early 80s.
How was he treated as a 13, 14, 15-year-old in juvenile detention?
Well, He went in at 13, and it's because his mother had said, you know, she's spending 6 hours at police stations or court just week after week, and she had two other kids at that stage, a mother with schizophrenia, a much younger sister to look after, and then Chris just eating up all the time with legal
trouble. She's sitting in court all the time, so she can't
get it. And she has no public transport, she's a single mother, all this. So, yeah, she asks, and Steve, the dad, Chris couldn't live with him because he's too much of a, you know, a violent man. So he goes in at 13 to a place in Melbourne, and he's beaten in there.
By who? By boys or guards?
Guards. And the guards say to him and the other kids, this is so you learn not to come back here. And, you know, as opposed to that teaching him anything, like don't come back, it becomes this kind of Nietzsche maxim of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
So it brutalizes him.
Brutalizes him, and he learns he can take a beating, you know.
What you've said reminds me of when I had Jack Hoisted on talking about some of Sydney's major criminals of the 60s and 70s and 80s. The thing they all had in common, whether it was Lenny McPherson or George Freeman or Christopher Dale Flannery, is that they went in for petty thieving into boys' homes in their early teens, brutalized by the guards and other boys, often sexually abused, and they came out the other end as completely hardened teenage criminals, full of rage. Was that his experience too?
Yeah, that's his experience. That's definitely his experience.
Was he sexually abused in these places? Did he say that, or was it just violent?
I asked him, and he says, no, he wasn't. The place he was in, Beltara, which is like the 13 and under section of Turana Boys Home in Melbourne, has turned up in the Royal Commission with tales of sexual abuse, but Chris says he was not. I asked him to be honest with me, you know, and if it did happen, he's too embarrassed to talk about it, but he just, you know, he's been pretty honest with me, and he says no, he was just bashed.
Just severely beaten.
Yeah. Mm. And he, you know, he escaped from there too, and he escaped from the maximum security section of the boys' home. And he would go and either run home to his mother, or he'd sleep in cars and things. He did this at a younger age too, just sleep in cars, break in, get money. He just had nowhere. Like, he couldn't live with his dad, couldn't live with his mother. He's beaten in the boys' home.
How does he talk about those feelings of rage that were in him from this age?
He just says it's like being wound up tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter until, you know, you just want to lash out and you can't take any authority from anyone, the imposition of any authority. So when he's released, you know, he won't pull over on his in his car or anything for breath tests or for speeding tickets, nothing. He just will not stop. And if bouncers push him or if people bump into him in bars or anything, has just triggers this monstrous rage in him. And from other ex-prisoners I've spoken to, that's very common, you know, like they get these wild kind of tempers. Jail just breeds, like, rage.
On the outside, tell me how he broke his neck at the age of 16.
Well, this is very symbolic of Chris and his life, you know. He was, about 16. He had a motorbike riding across Spotswood Golf Course in Melbourne and just doing burnouts, chewing up the grass, being a complete, you know, jerk, laughing at the golfers. And the golfers all started, like, who were really angry about this, all started teeing off at him. And, you know, trying to get him with the balls. Then they running after him with clubs, you know, like a bunch of villagers with pitchforks and things.
Right.
And then Chris is turning around, giving him the finger, doesn't see where he's going. And then when he turns around, it's too late and he crashes on a creek bed and breaks his neck and back. And that's his life, you know. It's wild, irresponsible highs followed by these devastating crashes.
And what was he like in hospital after the crash?
He was in traction and his mother came in to see him and he'd got himself into a wheelchair and was chasing nurses down the hall, trying to pinch them and just being, you know, completely naughty as hell. And also his dad was coming in, undoing the traction, giving him junk food and stuff and saying, sit up like a man, you know, in that traction, in the bed like that. That's not how a man sits up, you know. So his mother just just exploded, like, this is going to paralyze him. Any movement goes the wrong way, it could go severely wrong. So, yeah, he's just can't be held down.
At 17, after his grandmother's death, you're right, he went on this month-long, well, he admits he went on this month-long drug-fueled crime spree, which landed him in Pentridge for the first time. This is proper grown-up prison as opposed to juvenile detention. What was the change in dynamics like for him, going from juvenile detention to full-on prison?
It's been amongst all the hard men, you know, the fully formed or malformed men whose whole life, you know, for decades has been serious, serious crime and guns and fear and killings and, you know, who were also hardened amidst the kind of guerrilla war almost that the armed robbery scene was in Melbourne at the times, with killings by police, killings by the criminals.
This is the time of the Russell Street police station bombing and the Wall Street murders of police officers. So there was tit for tat going back and forth.
Yeah. And, you know, people being shot and then a gun planted on them and also the criminals killing people too. Yeah. This is the time, and the armed criminals, the heads of this sort of stuff, are the heroes in jail. So Chris sees them and it's like, oh, there's something to be, you know, something to aspire to.
He said that an older crim attacked him in Pentridge and he retaliated or defended himself by hot watering this guy, this older crim. What can you explain what hot watering is?
Hot watering is boiling a kettle and throwing the contents at someone. So that's a common kind of weapon in jail.
Right, so it's that commonplace. It's got its own kind of subsection of, like, it's got jargon attached to it.
They've got jargon for everything down there. It's like covering oneself in poo is called bronzing up.
And he did that too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he did that too. He was the bronze up king.
He was sent to H Division in Pentridge. And what kind of world was that in the 1980s?
Division, isn't it? That's where you get your notorious characters, Chopper Reed and others, in there. Multiple murderers, standover men who beat the hell out of people. And then Chris, who's, you know, a teenager. And
he's Chris, a teenager still. He's, what, 17, 18? The 17, 18?
Yeah, isn't he? I don't think he went to H Division at 17, but he was definitely by 19. And it's something he has to adapt to. It's like survival mode has to kick in. He forms what he calls a mutual defense unit with three other prisoners that vow to defend each other against attacks. Because there's people being stabbed and beaten and, you know, bodies taken out on gurneys. You know, like the ambulance is there most days.
Broadcast, podcast, on your mobile. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
You write that while he was in H Division in Pentridge, he tried to kill a notorious pedophile child killer named Derek Percy by throwing a Molotov cocktail into his cell. It didn't work in the end. It sort of bounced off something and didn't break open like he wanted it to. Nonetheless, he made a judgment about the pedophile child killer that he was scum of the earth. What's the moral logic at work here? Like, he's a crim as well. Like, he's involved in armed robbery and that kind of stuff. How does that moral system work in the mind of this of Christopher Bince?
Well, there are two things at play here, I think. One is just the conventional jail code that people who attack children are at the bottom of the scale and should be, you know, exterminated kind of thing. So that's pretty widespread through prison, hence child molesters, child killers and stuff are usually in protective custody or solitary themselves or grouped together in places where they're protected from other prisoners. So Chris is just, you know, in line with all that. But the other thing is, the more I spoke to him and stuff, the more I could see that he is almost obsessively protective of the idea of children and a man must protect kids. And so he, you know, you could say he's been reckless with his own kid. Like, he taught his own daughter to use a pistol with a silencer. He thought it might come in handy when there were people out to get him and they might come for her, or he might get killed and she might have to pick up a gun or something. But, you know, so his judgment might be questionable there, but it's based around this sort of manic defense of the idea of protect children at all costs. And I think it partly stems from him. He was like this lost kid with no one out to protect him when he was little. And so, you know, damned if he's going to let other people attack children.
He's released in 1988 and he was 19 years old from Pentridge. And he said, "I am released full of hate and rage, sourcing weapons and soon involved in acts of violence not seen before." This is hate and rage directed at police and prison officers that he finds on the outside. He just bumps into on the outside.
Yeah.
This, you know what this reminds me? It reminds me a lot of Ned Kelly, actually, the Girilderi letter, all this kind of hate and rage directed at authority. Not the civilian population, but these people in authority.
That's right. And how it works out here is Chris sees himself as a guerrilla, like a soldier fighting the state. And so when he gets out at that young age, he attacks government-owned institutions. Like, he attacks the State Bank of Victoria and the Commonwealth Bank, which was government-owned then, and the TAB, which was government-owned then.
So there's a political element to what he's doing in his mind, anyway, like Ned Kelly in that sense.
Yeah, because he got put into state care, and then he's beaten in state care, treated like dirt. So he responds by like, right, I'm getting payback, I'm getting compensation. So he just bursts into these state institutions like a bandit. You know, I mean, he's a bandit, and gets the money. And it's like, ha ha, like, stuff you. You know, I'm in control now.
And how good is he at armed robbery?
Superb. Like, he doesn't get like caught in the robberies, and he does dozens of them. And he cases places. Like, it's just fascinating to learn about it. He can walk to a bank, does research first, looks at all the roads everywhere, ways in and out. He often picks banks close to police stations just to up the degree of difficulty in Olympic terms, you know. And then he'll go in and have a look, and it's like, oh, okay, that's going to take me 10 seconds to cross the floor, 5 seconds to jump the cage that the tellers are behind. He works out which door to come in and out of. And then he starts, when he does the robberies, he learns that you shouldn't take opaque bags because they could stuff it with small denomination notes and coins. So he takes in clear freezer bags, and he'll just go in, take control of everything, as he calls it, control the floor, with his shotgun and yelling and his projection of personality.
So the first thing he's got to do in an armed robbery then is to terrify everyone.
Terrify.
In that room. Well, but does he need to fire his pump action shotgun to do that?
He has a couple times, but when he's fired, it's usually because there's an exit blocked, and he's blowing doors away with his shotgun to get in and out. People he's with, when he's had co-offenders at times, they've fired into ceilings. But his usual thing is it's just big voice. He's a muscly guy too, and he's wearing also two layers of clothes because he strips one off when he gets back into a car, so he's dressed differently all of a sudden. So he's a, you know, scary
very
guy.
Carefully. Will he use acts of violence to intimidate people in the bank? Bank tellers, bank managers? Will he, you know, hit them with a rifle butt or hit them with his fists or will he hurt them?
No, he has never needed to. He'll walk down the row of tellers, scaring the hell out of them with his gun, threatening them, and just slapping down a freezer bag in front of them saying, fill it up, you know, and only the big notes and things. And then he'll get to the end of the tellers and then walk his way back up collecting the bags. And then he's gone in 90 seconds. Two minutes, and he's out.
One occasion, he got on a train, didn't he?
Yeah.
Changed clothes, dumped his motorbike or something, walked away from it, and timed it so he could catch a train. Sat there with a big sports gym bag.
Yeah,
quite
listening to the sirens, and he timed it so that he'd get to the station with the train just about to come, and the police were probably looking for getaway cars screaming out of the joint, and there he is at the train station.
Does he admit to enjoying robbing banks?
Yeah. Yeah, he says he doesn't anymore. In his last robbery, he threw up. It made him so sick, but he felt he had to do it to get money to move his family when he felt they were in danger. But before that, in his heyday of robberies, he would get this huge rush out of it. And the police ask him why and all this, because he said it wasn't for drugs, wasn't even for the money. It was for the adrenaline, the excitement, the rush. That's it. Like, he's wired on it. I mean, it makes him just, feel like lightning's hit him.
He seems really mindful of the need not to hurt what he would call civilians, ordinary people going about their business, working or being in a bank or like that. Is he in any way mindful of the trauma and terror he inflicts on people in those scenes, those everyday people who find themselves, people who still suffer trauma from being present in a bank robbery, armed robbery from years and years ago. Is he aware of that, what the trauma he causes with that?
Well, at the time in his heyday, in those early years, no. And he reveled in what he did. But lately, he's written a lot of about how remorseful he is, how he understands trauma now. And he feels queasy about the whole thing. But before, no, he was oblivious to it.
He's in and out of prison. He goes back into H Division in Pentridge once he's caught. Once he's there, is there any attempt made to rehabilitate him or prepare him for life on the outside that's not involved in violent crime?
The prison system seems to have these courses you do to qualify for parole where you do anger management or this, that, and the other. But if you're in solitary, you generally don't do those. And he spends a lot of time in that because of his escapes in the early 90s, his wild, spectacular escapes and plots. He spent years in solitary before, like 3.5 years at a time in one spot and shackled every time he's out of his cell. And so he doesn't do these courses. And, the courses are kind of questionable all the time anyway. But no, he's just warehoused. This guy is just absolutely warehoused.
One occasion, he came extremely close to breaking out of a remand centre with a Perspex window by getting hold of a toaster, reconfiguring the element and actually burning an exit hole. But didn't quite pan up, but wow, it's pretty impressive he was able to do that. Tell me the time he actually escaped from Parramatta Jail, the old Parramatta Jail, how he managed to do that.
Well, about 6 weeks before he'd broken out of Pentridge via a hospital prison ward, and then he was on the run, did some robberies in Sydney, got arrested, and then put in Parramatta Prison. In Parramatta Prison, his father, who'd helped him escape from Pentridge via a hospital, died. And his father had been the proudest man on earth, according to other people, when Chris escaped from Pentridge with his help. Like, I've liberated my son, all this. But then 6 weeks later, the father was dying of heart failure. And then Chris is arrested again. The father is crushed, is like, apparently extremely depressed, like just absolute lowest of lows, and dies, is found dead on a couch. And then of a broken heart, literally and, symbolically, emotionally. Then Chris is in Parramatta dealing with this, feeling super guilty, like he's killed his father through this failure. And he decides to escape. So he has these, as I mentioned before, hacksaw blades thrown over a fence and brought to him for payment of pills and syringes. And then he starts cutting a bar in the jail. He's only got a short time each day to work on it. When he has to stop working, he fills in the cut with soap and then paints that soap with a kind of chrome color so it matches the bar. And what the escape will involve is pulling the bar out of the way, breaking out of the window, then abseiling down to a roof. The roof is a 45-degree slope down a crumbling slate roof. that ends with foot and a half high, 18-inch high razor wire, and then leaping from that 4 meters across to another roof.
4 meters?
Yeah, and with a drop of a couple stories down onto concrete, at a 4 meter leap over a razor wire on the other side onto another roof of the reception center, I think it was. And then from there to lasso like a pipe that sticks up, probably a ventilation pipe, and swing from that over a razor wire fence down to the outside. And Chris thought this will take 10 seconds. And so he got his girlfriend, Roxy, to bring a ute, a stolen ute, to the prison, park it, and then just when that 10 seconds starts, that synchronized, she would very slowly drive up to the fence, and so not too fast so it doesn't attract too much attention. And he's got his 10 seconds to do this, and then jump in the back of the ute and go. But he invited other prisoners, and they're all, yeah, Chris, we'll be in that and everything. But when they found out about the 4 meter jump, how it wasn't going to be a ladder.
Over razor wire, over a 4 story building, right, yes. They weren't quite so keen after that?
No.
Right.
No. And so he thought, okay, you know, it's like, oh, no, mate, I've got parole coming up, or I've got, right, you know, not that much time left or whatever. But Chris is going to do it. So he trains for it. He does hop, skip, and jump in the exercise yard. And people are going, what are you doing? Like, what's all this? And they thought something must be up. But he's going, oh, man, I like athletics, mate. You know, I've always loved this, Olympics and all that. So then the D-Day came. He bent the bar out of the way. He had his sheets tied up, abseiled down, did a one walk up and down the roof to size it up. Then the guards train in on him with the rifles. He starts sprinting. They shoot at him. He takes the leap. I said to him, how do you feel? Like, you're going to live or die? Or he said, to be honest, because his dad and everything dying, he said, I didn't care what happened, you know, which is might be why he made it. Like, he just did not care. And he makes the jump under gunfire from the towers, lands on the other side. His rope then snaps on the second part of it. So he falls, breaks his wrist in a partial fall, but then scrambles over the razor wire anyway, getting sliced up, leaps into the ute. She pulls a canvas over himself, she floors it, and they're gone. And then Jockey Smith, the notorious criminal, picks them up, they change cars and cruise away very slowly as the helicopters and sirens and everything are everywhere.
So he got out. He did it.
And then, you know, the reporting of it afterwards is guards saying, mate, he's got more testosterone than I do. It's Batman and all this. He did it. And, you know, he says there's still his imprint of his feet, you know, in the other roof that he landed on. But incredible physical feat, you know.
While he gets thrown back into solitary after he gets caught again, his period on the outside is always very short.
Very short.
He gets caught again and gets put into solitary once again. And he begins this disgusting process of bronzing up, where he covers his own body with his own feces. Why does he do that? What is that all about?
Well, he's explained it a few different ways. One of them is that if they give me their poo, I'm going to give them mine, you know.
Right.
But basically, he was inspired by the IRA. So in the Mays prison, the notorious Mays prison in Northern Ireland, the IRA prisoners were getting routinely beaten the hell out of by guards. But once they started covering their cells and themselves too with poo, no one wanted to go near them. And so Chris did this. It's like all prisoners have is their body. You know, if everything's taken out of the cell, like Chris spends also time in these observation cells when he's self-harmed or gone berserk, or they just want to like get him again. It's like there's nothing in there, no TV, no radio, no items, just him. And so what's left but blood, urine, and feces, you know.
So how does he stand it? What does he tell you about it?
Well, I asked him, how can you do that without throwing up? And he goes, oh, mate, you know, you're just acclimatized to it. You spend about half an hour. You put on your jocks, your runners and sunglasses, and then you spend half an hour gradually covering yourself. And I said,
it's disgusting, but I suppose it's exciting in a stupid way, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I just, you know, maybe I'm phobic or something, or germaphobe, but I just can't come at it. And I said, how can you do that without just throwing up? And he said, oh, you don't use the real old stuff. Well, that'd make you gag, you know. So he said he spent about two weeks.
He's a connoisseur, is he?
Yeah. He spent about 2 weeks collecting your poo in milk cartons. And then he said you mix it with urine to get the right consistency, and then you put it onto your war paint, you know. And it's this ultimate, like, depraved state of you versus the state, I guess. It's like you've taken everything away from me but my poo, and so I'm going to use my poo against you. And he throws it at the guards too and sprays it, you know.
He was put in solitary for years, essentially, as a result. And it seems to break his spirit. It has broken his spirit. He doesn't seem to want to go back to crime, but he sort of has to anyway because that's all he can do. That's how he sees it.
And the psych reports say he reverts to that childhood state of, like his last time out, he ended up sleeping in his car and doing a robbery. And the psychologist said this is him as a kid, breaking into cars or sleeping in cars, camping and stealing to get by. It's like when everything overwhelms him, he reverts.
Well, that's all he knows of the outside world. But he hasn't finished school. He has no other way of interacting with the outside world, knows no other way to do that, I suppose.
He didn't even finish year eight, you know. And he's an intelligent man. He wrote a lot for me. And, you know, he's got a sense of timing, suspense, theatre, way with words. His mind is active, but it's developed in certain areas very powerfully, and in others he's still a kid, you know, totally undeveloped. And so the education is just completely lacking, you know, in the personal development.
On the outside, he was released in 2005 after 13 straight years in jail, much of it in solitary, and went on a media blitz. Appeared at a press conference with now Greens Senator Lee Rhiannon, talking for prison reform and saying that solitary confinement is an inhuman abuse of human rights. It's actually a kind of cruel and unusual detention. Was anyone buying it at the time? How interested was the public in his message?
Not that interested, you know. Mm. Like he went on a few things, the Law Report on Radio National, and he got a fair bit of media out of it, and he went to the parliament and he gave a press conference with Lee Rhiannon. He had distributed questionnaires in Goulburn Prison in the maximum section.
What, other prisoners?
Yeah, with the help of guards who shouldn't have been doing that, but did, because even guards who he's, like, you know, screamed at and scared and everything and abused and God knows what, a lot of them still respect him, if not like him, because he is not just a maniac who exists for himself. He has done these things. So he distributed a questionnaire asking prisoners, what rehabilitation have you received in here? What are your conditions like? And what do you think you need to sort of get a handle on your worst tendencies and so on? And guards helped him with it. And then he collected it and took it out. He took it to Lee Rhiannon, and then he tried to take it to the Justice Minister in New South Wales, who wouldn't receive it, wouldn't meet him, nothing, because he's a scumbag crim, you know. I will not be, talking to this man, sort of stuff.
So he goes and holds up an armoured car not long after that. A year
later. He tried to, but he, yeah.
Oh, sorry, sometime after that. Jail term. It's hard to keep track of his in and outs of prison at this time.
Yeah. 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 He's like a fascinating guy, and he does do things altruistically yet manipulatively at times, and he is a very problematic guy, but he does also campaign for general improvement of prison so that people don't come out as bad or worse than them when they went in.
After this armed robbery of an armour guard van, he was finally caught after a siege in the outer Melbourne suburb of East Keilor that lasted 44 hours. And during that siege, he fired some bullets, but who or what was he firing the bullets at?
The armoured car. The police drove up in an armoured car and got on the loudspeaker, like, you know, Chris, come out, all this kind of thing. And every now and then, Chris would just take a shot at it, at the armoured car. The bullet would bounce off and the car would reverse out and park down the road a bit. And so that was kind of that, you know. I should say in there too, he was... I asked him, what happened? How did he go through 44 hours of this? And eventually they pump in loads of tear gas and stun grenades that set fire to the place and all this. And he said, oh, I don't know, mate, I slept through most of it. And I said, what? He goes, oh, I just slept. I said, how'd you do that when you're smoking ice? Because he told me also that he got an ice problem when he came out, because the drugs have all changed too. Before, he'd done some speed sometimes, you know, old-fashioned speed that lots of people have done that, you know, zips people up, whatever. But methamphetamine is a whole different thing, you know. And he comes out and he gets right into it, because he's also paranoid. He's got people hunting him. He's in a war with a prison gang and all this. And he's doing surveillance on people. Ice gets a grip. And when his siege happens, he's just smoking it. And I said, how do you go to sleep after smoking methamphetamine? And he goes, oh, mate, I don't know what it does to other people, but it kind of mellows me out. You know, I can sleep on it. It's like, it takes the edge off. So, you know, this is a guy whose contemporaries, a lot of them are heroin addicts and things, but Chris just, that's boring. Heroin's just boring. Like, he just loves the pure electricity of rampant will, you know. This is like he is a maniac. And, you know, there are causes and things psychologists will and have pointed to and stuff. But ultimately, this guy is a total life wire, you know, who just smokes ice to calm down.
So now he's 5 years into this, what, 18-year sentence? I
think yeah.
Yeah. 23 hours a day in solitary confinement. What are your thoughts about that? What do you think now about his putting a criminal like him in solitary confinement round, year after year after year like that?
Oh, I think it's ridiculous. You know, this doesn't have to be that way, and it's not in other places. And, you know, really out of the 6,000-plus prisons in Victoria, they're saying there's not two or three guys that Chris could even play ping pong with under guard supervision for an hour or two a day. I mean, it's just... there's no imagination to any of this, you know. And I looked up the recruiting thing for guards in Victoria, and it's 36 days training, which involves self-defense, use of the weapons they have, how to search people and search cells and whatnot. And then you compare it to what a lot of the criminal justice people I spoke to said to look at was Norway, where it's 2 to 3 years training, and it's in sociology, psychology, welfare, law, a whole lot of ways to understand the people they're dealing with and to make it a kind of a therapeutic community that the person is in that is not utterly divorced from society, but yeah, is part of it.
That better training's got to be good for the officers, but prison officers as well, doesn't it? Help them to deal psychologically with the
You
know, the challenge of people who like to bronze up occasionally, as you say.
I mean, you know, yeah. I don't want to put down the guards or anything like this. You know, it's a tough job with not a lot of training and you know, not quite the profession it should be yet.
I suppose we have to ask the question with, what do we want this kind of detention to achieve? What do we really want to get out of this by putting a man like him in solitary confinement for year after year after year after year like that?
Well, it's convenient. It's lower manpower in a way.
Stops him from escaping. I mean, and that's an embarrassment to authorities. It means having you know, another an armed robber on the loose yet again.
But, you know, do we want to destroy people to stop them escaping? And the other thing is... it's not just the solitary, it's the whole jail system. Like, he's been in it since he was 13. And what is it built up to? I mean, what kind of growth personally has he had access to, you know, the means to in jail? It's just, it's a dumb system. I mean, it's...
is it serving the cause of public safety? I mean, I think that's probably in most people's minds the uppermost value you'd want to uphold in our prison system, to keep the public safe from violent criminals.
Well, all these people get out. I mean, that's the problem. If you put someone, you warehouse them in a cage around the clock almost and treat them like this, they still get out. And then what happens? You know, you get these wound up, disturbed people in there who, you know, like one psychologist was saying to me, if you put a dog in a laundry and leave it there, it'll play with its poo, walk in circles, butt its head, chew its legs, all this stuff. And, you know, people do the same thing. Then you let it go later. It's just, you know... counterproductive as well as being somewhat inhuman.
Did you talk to any of his victims? I mean, when I say victims, I mean people present at the scene of the armed robberies he perpetrated.
Oh, I put in a lot of victim statements for it, and a lot of them were stripped out because of suppression orders, as it turned out. But I've got in there, like, just how shocking his rampages through the banks and whatnot were. I mean, they were deeply... scary. And you know, one kid apparently pooed his pants when Chris burst in, you know, roaring with a gun. It's like, this is a warts and all thing. Chris is not, I'm not telling people he's a good guy or a bad guy or anything. This is a raw blast of this man and what it's like to be him. And people can make up their own minds, you know. It's, I'm not here to interpret him as a, you know, a decent bloke or a terrible bloke. It's
but like, you have tried to get into his head.
Yeah.
Is that a dangerous thing? Is it hard to... are you a bit different now that you've tried to crawl in there and you've had to crawl back out again?
Yeah, yeah. And it was the most grueling writing experience I've had. Even though I've spent, you know, months and months in dodgy circumstances in dangerous places for other books, this one, at first I wanted to believe in a kind of cause and effect thing, like the obvious socio-economic stuff and, you know, what jail's been like. But also, I mean, his brother's different to him and his brother's got the same parents and whatnot. Chris hasn't benefited from the prison system. And part of that is there is just in the soul of Chris, there is this love of intensity, this manic element. And once I understood that, there's an irrational side as well as the rational reasons. it clicked and it poured out of me thousands and thousands of words a day. And I was writing 22 hours, 24 hours sometimes, 1 hour sleep back into it. I got deranged, unhinged. My family thought I was going insane. I mean, it was, you know, I got really unhealthy from it. It was, you know, bad news doing it like that. But that's when it really came together.
It's a fascinating insight. I learned a lot from reading that book, and it's great to speak with you about it, Matthew, and thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Richard. Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Matthew Thompson's the author of Mayhem, The Strange and Savage Saga of Christopher Badness Bince. abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.